Hub.
And Spoke. Audio Collective.
When Bob Dole was campaigning for the presidency against Bill Clinton, this is back in the mid-1990s, he said this: "If we want to ensure that all of our children have the same opportunities, yours, mine, everyone's, in America, alternative language education should stop." He was talking about bilingual education, specifically, mainly, Spanish-speaking kids taking math and history and other subjects in Spanish. He wanted everyone to learn English, learn in English, so that one day they'd be able to speak English as well as anyone else. And he was talking about this maybe because he believed it, but also because it was a popular opinion. Today, many high schoolers have something called a seal of biliteracy that appears on their transcript or diploma. It verifies that the holder has attained a high level of proficiency in two or more languages. It's a very public acknowledgement of the value of bilingual education. What happened between 1995 and Bob Dole's appeal to voters? And this year, 2024, when South Dakota became the 50th state to adopt the seal of biliteracy. What happened? From Quiet Juice and the Linguistic Society of America, this is Subtitled: Stories About Languages and the People Who Speak Them. I'm Patrick Cox. There's a ton of research about bilingualism. You can find studies about bilingual baby talk, about speaking in different registers, about how we think in different languages, or think we think, about how we learn, how we function, how we age. It's exhausting. So in this episode, we are going to hear about research in just two subject areas: bilingual education, always a topic of disagreement, and before that, language acquisition, the language or languages you learn from the start of your life. Here's a study, a recent study out of the University of Texas. 300 infants are tested on various tasks. The bilingual babies among them perform the tasks more efficiently than their monolingual counterparts. These infants are aged between 6 months and 10 months old. Wow.
I can beat that, Patrick. I can go much younger.
This is Ari Daniel. He's a science reporter with NPR, and you may have heard him on other episodes of Subtitle. He says researchers are now studying bilingualism from the very beginnings of language acquisition.
It actually starts way earlier than we ever thought, and researchers are learning more by looking not just at the sounds we make, but at a language's rhythm and pitch as well. You ready?
Go for it.
Okay, so Patrick, I want you to go back to when you were a kid and listen to this.
Neighbor, everybody needs good neighbor.
Oh, yes, I recognize that. I don't think American listeners will do, because this is an Australian soap, right?
Yep.
Neighbors.
Yes.
It played in the United Kingdom. I don't think it ever played over here, right?
Yeah, good job.
Not one of my favorites, I have to say.
Next door is only a footstep away.
In the late 80s, a British psychologist published a study showing that pregnant moms who watch Neighbors every day gave birth to babies who reacted more strongly to the theme song than those whose moms didn't watch the show.
That is the first paper which has shown that fetuses can be exposed to a specific type of sound and then elicit some sort of a reaction to them after they have been born.
Eino Partanen is a Finnish neuroscientist at Aarhus University Hospital in Denmark. Partanen wasn't involved in the soap opera study, but it's inspired a bunch of his work, including a cool thing he and his colleagues tried a few years ago while in Finland. They took a group of pregnant moms, and for 15 minutes a day, 5 days a week, during their last trimester, he asked them to play this, loud.
Ta ta ta, ta ta ta,
Wow.
It doesn't sound like a Finnish music hit.
No, sadly. Even for Finns, that would be annoying.
How do you find moms that want to do that?
Through friends and relatives who don't dare to say no, mostly.
Plus through internet discussion boards. And occasionally in the recording, the middle syllable of the ta-ta-ta sequence would be swapped out for a different vowel.
Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Really, Ari? Is there a difference there?
Yeah, it goes ta-ta-ta-ta-to-ta. Listen one more time.
Ta-ta-ta-ta-to-ta. Okay, I hear that, but it's really subtle. Just the middle syllable, right?
Right. And Partanen did one other thing with the middle syllable. Sometimes he changed its pitch. And then, just days after they were born, Partanen played the stimuli to the newborns and used an EEG to monitor their brain activity. He compared it to a group of newborns who didn't receive the in utero ta-ta-ta stimulation. The results couldn't be clearer. Both groups of babies responded identically to the sequence with the different vowel.
Ta-ta-ta.
Because that second vowel's heard all the time in Finnish. You don't need a special recording to be exposed to it as a fetus. But only the babies who'd been exposed in utero to the pitch change recognize it once they're born. And that's because, just as in English, pitch isn't relevant in Finnish, compared to some languages, Chinese for example, where words take on different meanings based on pitch. So babies that don't hear different pitches in utero don't respond to them later. Or, more simply, babies respond to the signals they first hear in utero. And of course, these signals can come from one language or many languages.
The way I think of the early development is the fetal stage builds up specific predispositions to what we're going to experience later on after we've been born. Babies are not born as a blank slate.
Rather, a kind of groundwork gets laid in utero that familiarizes us with the world we're about to encounter. And if that world has more than one language, we also prep for that in utero.
A lot of language crosses the uterine wall, and so that by the time a baby is born, they're not an inexperienced listener.
Janet Worker is a developmental psychologist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
It's a very multilingual city. We have babies growing up in all sorts of combinations of languages.
Including bilingual homes where English and Filipino are spoken, two languages with different spoken rhythms. And Worker wanted to know whether babies exposed to English and Filipino in utero are familiar with both languages at birth, and whether they can differentiate between them. She and her colleagues worked with newborns several hours to several days old. Granted, it's a tricky population.
They don't talk yet. They don't point. They don't follow instructions.
So she wired a pressure sensor up to a pacifier.
Babies will change their rate of sucking, their strength of sucking, and you can condition the sucking reflex.
Which is to say that how much a baby sucks, or how strongly that baby sucks, can tell you how familiar and interesting something is to the baby. Like these muffled speech samples that Worker played, filtered to sound like they would in the womb.
In this case, the easiest solution seems to occur.
This is English.
This is the first time that this international expedition has occurred in this town.
And this is Filipino.
And the year it been believed that it's going to be shown within happen.
The results.
From the moment a newborn baby is born who's growing up in a bilingual environment, they listen preferentially to speakers of either of the languages they heard in utero. And they're able to track the rhythmical properties of each. So they're born ready to learn two languages and not confuse them.
Worker says all this learning before birth might be useful. First, it may allow babies to identify who's part of their community once they're born. And second, just from rhythm cues, babies may be able to track how certain words function and give them a head start on learning that language. All this might come in handy when considering early interventions for things like dyslexia. These are still hypotheses, so Worker appreciates a more concrete and intimate lesson, one she's learned by watching the parents watching their babies in an experiment like this.
It communicates to the parent that their baby is interested in the world around them and is interested in learning from the first moments of life. And we like to think that this might make them treat their baby as the curious, involved little being that they are.
Okay, I get it. Newborns, they may seem kind of unformed. They can't do very much. But don't be fooled. There's a ton going on.
And even before that, even before they're born, language is such an irresistible force to us. It finds its way into the womb, and it makes connections not just in the baby's brain, but also between the baby inside and the world outside.
Yeah, and in one or several languages, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's one or more appears to really affect how the brain functions.
Yes.
Okay, Ari. So my kid, who you've met and mm-hmm. played charades
yes,
with.
Yes, we had a good time.
She's bilingual, English and Chinese. Should I award myself a gold star for that? Does she have what some people call the bilingual edge?
You know, I asked Janet Worker about this in particular, and I said, does raising a kid in a bilingual environment give that kid some advantage? And she said that, yes, there are certain advantages, like in the realm of what's called executive function, the ability to switch between different tasks. But on the other hand, Janet Worker told me that often a bilingual kid will have a smaller vocabulary in each language than a monolingual kid, unless the bilingual kid is a really avid reader and then they can kind of make up for it. So there are differences growing up monolingual versus bilingual. It's not like one is better than the other. The key is that babies adapt to the language environment that they're in when they're born and even before. So doing well in the world really starts with doing well in the womb.
After the break, Ari Daniel is back with researchers looking into the contested area of bilingual education. It's podcast recommendation time. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted, from flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska. Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week. You'll find a few in your feed by now. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, wherever you listen to podcasts. Okay, now bilingual education. California is ground zero for this. In 1998, a group of Californians collected enough signatures to get a measure on the ballot, a measure that would almost completely outlaw bilingual education. The governor of California at the time was a Republican, and voters there had recently passed an anti-immigrant ballot initiative. And now there was this ballot measure promising to ban bilingual ed, which was kind of code for banning Spanish in schools. It passed. Fast forward a couple of decades, and the California legislature, now overwhelmingly Democratic, with plenty of Latino representation, it decides that voters need to vote again on bilingual ed.
In California, one proposition on the November ballot would repeal one that was passed nearly 20 years ago.
CBS 13's Tony
So Lopez. There's a new measure that would reintroduce several different forms of bilingual ed back into California schools. And this measure, it also wins at the polls. And it wasn't even close. 74%. Vote yes.
¿Cómo se llama?
Castle.
Castillo.
It's getting them ready for the world, to prepare them to be college and career ready. So.
And this repeal vote, well, a lot of people outside California missed it for understandable reasons. There was another election result from that ballot that was hogging the headlines. Donald Trump was heading to the White House. What changed Californians' minds about bilingual education? Why such a dramatic reversal in such a short period of time, 18 years? There were, of course, during that time, observations from teachers and other educators about what was working, what wasn't, who was learning, who wasn't, which students were dropping out. But more than that, there was the research. Not just research on babies and infants, but on older kids too. Research that continues to this day and continues to reveal new things, nuances that we weren't clear about before. At the root, though, of all of these studies is the same question, endlessly picked at by researchers. Does being bilingual carry an advantage?
And that question is, at least in the US, the subject of a heated discussion.
I know when to hand back the reins to Ari Daniel.
It's not a simple pro versus con debate, says Thomas Bach, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Edinburgh.
If we approach a topic as complex as bilingualism, to believe that you can practically give a simple yes and no answer is, for me, quite naive.
Let's pull apart some of that complexity. A good starting place, says Judith Kroll, a psycholinguist at UC Riverside, is to know that in the bilingual brain, both languages are active at all times, even when just one of those languages is being spoken.
Bilinguals develop exquisite control to be able to master and regulate the use of the two languages.
That control allows bilinguals to switch between their languages, select one language while suppressing the other, and focus on what they're communicating in the moment.
The idea is that control isn't necessarily limited to language itself, but may spill over into other domains of cognitive function.
Like ignoring irrelevant information and paying attention to what's useful, or juggling different tasks. And Thomas Bach says there may be big payoffs for bilinguals much later in life, too.
I was involved in studies showing that people who speak more than one language have slower cognitive aging, have also 4.5 years later onset of dementia, and recover faster after stroke.
And some of these benefits may pertain not just to those who grow up bilingually, but also to those who learn another language as adults. These studies are part of a large body of work published over the last 2 decades that reveal an about-face in how we think about bilingualism in the United States. It used to be viewed with suspicion as an impediment to learning. Now it's the opposite, where bilingualism is seen as beneficial to some degree, though not by everyone.
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say that I'm one of the leading skeptics.
Recently, Ken Papp, a cognitive psychologist at San Francisco State University, has been critiquing the studies demonstrating bilingual advantage. He argues that the control required to master and deploy two languages doesn't necessarily transfer to other domains. He questions the demographics of the populations being tested. And he says that if researchers don't detect a bilingual advantage in a particular study,
they're likely to just place the results of their study in their file drawer and never attempt to publish it. Likewise, reviewers and editors, their typical reaction is, well, that's pretty boring, and those manuscripts are likely to be rejected.
Initially, Thomas Bach welcomed these criticisms.
Debate is healthy in science. It's necessary.
But Bach says that he and other researchers have responded to Ken Papp with studies that have nipped his complaints in the bud. Still, Papp's persisted in vocalizing and publishing his same doubts. Bach says it's time to move on. Yet Papp's not alone in his critique. Christiana Fellbaum, a computational linguist at Princeton, says there's conflicting evidence when it comes to the studies examining bilingual advantage.
Almost all experiments that I have seen are flawed.
Flawed, she says, in a couple serious ways.
The number of participants tends to be small. Virtually no two bi or multilinguals have identical profiles. So as a consequence, it's difficult, if not impossible, to set up a reproducible experiment.
It does seem to me that there are naysayers.
Psycholinguist Judith Kroll again.
Who are willing to take a couple of failures to replicate to essentially destroy the entire field, to dismiss all of the rest of the evidence.
To be fair, Fellbaum isn't out to destroy the entire field, and she says bilingualism may indeed have some advantages. So does all this back and forth amount to anything more than academic infighting? Well, the answer to that question is something folks agree on.
I think it's the potential implications for public policy decisions that we make as a society.
Our science, it is done in a society we live in.
And this is where we get to the election in California. Ron Unz, a software developer and theoretical physicist by training, was one of the chief organizers of an initiative passed in 1998 that made bilingual education programs in the state's public schools a rarity.
The way to make a child from that background bilingual is for the schools to teach them what they do not know, which is English, than for the schools to just teach them what they already know, which is Spanish.
Wow, Ari, that's so interesting to hear Ron Unz now. I remember him back in 98 when that first proposition was on the ballot. And his view, it seemed to be the majority view of Californians to get kids speaking and understanding English as quickly as possible. And that ballot proposition that he championed, that voters overwhelmingly approved it, didn't they?
That's right, 61% to 39%. And like you say, California was a different place then. There was still a lot of suspicion of bilingualism. And also, there was this belief that kids shouldn't be allowed to learn in their native language, that if they did, they just wouldn't learn English.
Right, right. So what has changed in the meantime?
Part of it is that there's all this research that's been done that I've been telling you about that suggests a possible bilingual edge. And also, California's demographics have changed. It's gotten even more multi-ethnic and more multilingual.
And what about the teaching methods? They've changed as well, right? I mean, there's been this great rise in dual language immersion schools where kids are taught, you know, whatever it is, math, science, history, in two languages, in English for part of the day, in the second language for the other part of the day. That must have had an effect too, hasn't it?
Right, because dual language programs in public schools tend to be very popular among parents. Many have really long waiting lists. And there are findings churned up by this discussion surrounding bilingual advantage. For example, researchers have found some evidence that bilinguals are better learners. Take a study that Thomas Bach conducted with a group of Scottish elementary schoolers. Most kids in Scotland learn in English only, as you probably know, Patrick, but a small number of them learn in both English and Scottish Gaelic.
Kids who are taught both in English and Gaelic are better in English spelling than kids that are only taught in English. So kids who learn two languages, their English spelling gets better.
And Bach, who speaks seven languages, says the debate over bilingual education has little resonance in countries where speaking more than one language is unexceptional.
If we simply go across the world, we will find that in many countries, bilingual education or multilingual education is absolutely the norm with very good results.
Which brings us to an important point. The larger academic controversy over bilingual advantage occurs primarily in places where being monolingual is the norm, like the U.S.
The biggest opposition comes from countries where there is also a very strong negative attitude to bilingualism in the society, ingrained mistrust against anybody who speaks other language than their own.
And this casts the opposition to bilingual education in a place like California in an unfortunate light, says Christiana Fellbaum.
It comes down to anti-foreign sentiment and perhaps even racism. It's a very strong word, but I will use it here. People are anxious about immigrants, and there is a reasonably clearly defined target population.
Meaning the Latino community. Ron Unz, the one who helped get the 1998 initiative passed, says that's nonsense. So where does this leave us? Christiana Fellbaum, for one, even with her reservations over the extent to which bilinguals are advantaged, she always offers couples who speak different languages the same piece of advice on how to raise their kids.
I said, by all means, bring them up bilingually because your children will relate to both of your heritage and be able to look at the world with different perspectives.
And with that kind of openness, who knows, maybe those kids will be the ones to resolve long-standing, heated discussions.
After its 18-year ban, California is still playing catch-up when it comes to bilingual education. Since the lifting of the ban in 2016, many new dual-language immersion programs have come into being, as well as other ways in which kids are being taught in either their native language or a second language. But researchers say it's simply too early to assess these programs, how effective they are. The pandemic, especially, has muddied the waters. So it's going to be a while until we hear anything conclusive. Until then, and probably after then as well, people will continue to argue about the merits of bilingual education. Yay! Thanks to Ari Daniel. He's a science reporter with NPR. If you haven't heard it, check out his fabulous subtitle episode from earlier this season. It's called How the Brain of an Improv Performer Works. Ari's also, as we noted before, a charades player, the world's best. Thanks also to Nina Porzucchi, and also to Allison Shao, who writes the subtitle newsletter and manages our social media accounts. And thanks to the World Public Radio Program. We'll be back in a fortnight. I feel I can say fortnight in the US. At least now there's a Taylor Swift song called Fortnight. Am I right? Thanks for listening.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.